the context for this very simple
Dan Bernstein,
problem.
Lecture 2.
This problem comes up in factorization, the number field sieve, or for example, the Q sieve, is that we're trying to find not small factors, we're trying to find large factors of some number n, some really big number n, which, for instance, factored by the Q sieve, we write down a bunch of congruences. I is congruent to n plus I. All we need is the product I times n plus I. I'm calling it a congruence. If we somehow identify enough smooth congruences, enough congruences that factor completely into primes less than or equal to y, products of powers of primes less than or equal to y, and then if we combine them appropriately, we will have at least a chance of factoring n, which experimentally is a 50% chance, and then it's easy to get that up to basically 100% chance. So the basic problem in the Q-sieve is to figure out which values of I, given n, which values of I are y smooth. Well, not just I is y smooth, but I times n plus I is y smooth. The definition of enough is approximately that there have to be more of these smooth congruences than primes less than or equal to y. So enough basically means bigger than y over log y. And if you have, say, 2y over log y, 3y over log y, that's certainly going to be enough. Well, we can't prove anything, but in practice, just slightly bigger than the number of primes up to y is fine. We believe that if y gets up to a certain complicated function, which relates to the u to the minus u chance of smoothness, that's the chance that a number up to n to the 1 over u is, a number up to n is n to the 1 over u smooth, is about u to the minus u. Dickman's row function is more precise, and you heard some stuff last week about more accurate approximations to the probability, but u to the minus u is good enough for this level of detail. Turning around that u to the minus u formula, you see that if y, this parameter y in factoring n, is something much smaller than n. As n gets bigger, this e to the square root of 1 half log n log n is smaller than n to the 1/10, eventually smaller than n to the 1/20. This becomes much, much smaller than n as n grows, smaller than any constant power of n. If y is about this e to the square root of 1 half log n, the little o of 1 is something that converges to 0, y, for any function that converges to 0 here, it is reasonable to conjecture that out of about y squared congruences, or some other function that converges to 0, well, this whole exponent converges to 2, it's reasonable to conjecture that about y squared congruences will provide enough smooth congruences, more than about y over log y, number of primes up to y. All right, so if y is chosen appropriately, and you look at y squared congruences, then you will find something like y congruences, and that's enough to form a square in the Q sieve and factor n. The linear sieve, which I haven't talked about, the quadratic sieve, which you heard a bit about last week, random squares method, which has the virtue of provability, the number field sieve, which is the record-setting state-of-the-art method that I described the algebra of last time, these all have the same flavor. Maybe the I times n plus I changes into something more complicated, but basically you write down a bunch of integers and you hope to find enough smooth integers, which by combining them appropriately give you squares that are the same modulo n, and from that you hopefully extract the factor of n. And in practice, despite all the hopefullys, this actually works. The same techniques are also used. You heard about a general outline of index calculus. And, well, in general, if you want to compute discrete logarithms, compute class groups, there's quite a few computations that all boil down to the same combination of congruence ideas. You write down a bunch of congruences and try to find enough smooth ones that you can multiply them together to form a square. You might ask, by the way, what happens if you don't look for y smooth congruences, if you try to multiply together any congruences to form a square? And, well, if you think about it, if there's a big prime in some congruence, then it's not going to multiply by any other congruences to form a square, because you're never going to see that big prime again. You need to have small primes for them to be repeated. If you have some gigantic prime, then chances are it's not going to divide any of the other congruences you write down, unless you force it to. That was the sublattices idea from last time. But generally, if you have a big prime in your congruences, then it's not going to show up again. So you need to have smoothness. You need to have congruences factoring completely into products of small primes in order for them to multiply, to have some subset multiplying to form a square. All right, so that's the context that leads to the problem of finding small factors, even though the objective is to find large factors of n. I have a picture here of the data flow in looking at a bunch of congruences with finding small factors in the middle as the critical subroutine. what you do is you start with any number of congruences. So here, consider, say, all the positive integers I. And then out of those, well, you don't look at infinitely many congruences, you just look at the smallest ones. You just take, say, I between 1 and y squared. So you just try to find the smallest numbers, I times n plus I, but enough of them so that you have a chance of this whole thing succeeding. The reason to look at the smallest ones is, well, small numbers are more likely to be smooth. This selection is very easy for I times n plus I. It becomes more complicated in the number field sieve and, well, even in the quadratic sieve. Selecting the smallest congruences is a little bit tricky, but okay, that's something that is doable. I'll talk more about that optimization next time. Starting from smallest congruences, say the I times n plus I's, where I runs from 1 up to 100, 1 up to y squared, you find the small factors of each congruence. As in the picture that I drew last time, you find the factors 2, 3, 5, 7 in each I and in each n plus I. That gives you partial factorizations, not necessarily complete factorizations, of all of your congruences, all the smallest ones that you fed to this fine small factor subroutine. And then you throw away, you abort the non-smooth congruences. You take the integers that are not completely factored into primes less than or equal to y, you throw them away, and that leaves you with some number of smooth congruences, hopefully enough to complete the factorization. The critical step here, the unobvious step of how do we actually do this as quickly as possible, is finding the small factors in the middle. And so that's the topic for today. You could, of course, just use trial division. This takes polynomial time in y. Y is the main parameter here. There's, again, to remind you of how many of these things there are, there's something like y squared, or maybe exactly y squared congruences, if you state the algorithm as I did last time. And out of that, well, you find factorizations of those y squared congruences using primes less than or equal to y. At the end, you have only about y, or y over log y, smooth congruences. But the bottleneck here is dealing with the y squared congruences. If you handle them by trial division, if you say, okay, for each of these numbers, I times n plus I, I'll try dividing it by 2, and if it's divisible by 2, then get rid of that 2 and divide it by 2 again, and keep going 3, 5, 7, and continue until y, then, of course, that will detect whether the number is smooth or not, but it also takes quite a few operations. The time for handling each congruence, the number of bit operations for each congruence, is, well, you have to go through all the primes less than or equal to y, and there's something like y over log y of those primes. And, well, the divided by log y is the sort of thing that gets absorbed into this little of 1. Y over log y, I can rewrite as y to the 1 minus, y to the 1 minus log log y over log y, and that log log y over log y converges to 0. Basically, y over log y is y. To be precise, it's y to the 1 plus little of 1, y to the 1 plus something that converges to 0, and that's the number of primes you have to look at. Also, the time to do each trial division, to do division by 7, for instance, is linear in the size of the congruences you're looking at, which, given the sizes of y and n, is also absorbed into the little o of 1. The real bottleneck here is for each of these y squared congruences having to do basically y divisions, and that's y squared times y, a total of y cubed bit operations. Everything I'm going to be saying today is trying to get that exponent of 3 down as close as possible to 2. And while improving the little o of 1, trying to really squeeze out the exponent, trying to make this as small as possible. It's not a huge improvement if you just look at the exponent from 3 down to 2, say, well, it's 2/3 the exponent. On the other hand, if you think, hey, y could be a billion, some of the cutting edge factorizations people are talking about, or even beyond that, in the future, we're imagining y being as big as 2 to the 40, about 10 to the 12th. And then the difference between y cubed and y squared, well, that's a factor of y. That's a factor of more than a billion, a factor of 10 to the 12th, and that's quite a savings. So we do care about reducing the exponents in these computations, even from just 3 down to 2. And I'll try to do that. I'll show you the state of the art in finding small primes as quickly as possible. One of the most important speed-ups is an idea called early aborts. This is something I should say as a matter of language. You've heard a little bit about large primes, and that's all subsumed by what I'm going to say about early aborts. There's differences in language for describing things. The early aborts terminology is broader, more general, and I'm going to stick to it, but if you've heard about large primes, then trust me that that's an example of early aborts. I'm changing the picture here slightly of what's going on. We don't actually need to find small factors reliably. We don't need to find, for each of these y-squared congruences, what are all the smooth congruences out of those. We just need to find enough smooth congruences, which maybe we could do by having some luck finding some smooth congruences, and then we miss some because we don't have a perfectly reliable detection method, and we go on to some other congruences. Remember that at the top of the picture, there's a never-ending supply of congruences. There are infinitely many I's to look at, I times n plus I's to look at. In the sublattices context, they were all about the same size. For the number field sieve, it's a bit more complicated to say exactly how big those congruences are, but basically there's as many congruences as you want. And out of those, you pick the smallest ones. Well, you don't have to pick just y squared of them. You could pick somewhat more. And then instead of factoring them all up to y, suppose you just figure out the prime factor is less than or equal to the square root of y, which does not completely tell you if the number is smooth or not, but it gives you a hint. If you have a number that has a lot of prime factors less than the square root of y, then it's more likely to be smooth than a number that doesn't have a lot of prime factors less than or equal to y. So now the extra step here is an early abort. You look at the partial factorizations. You take all the numbers I times n plus I, 1 times 612, 2 times 613, and so on. You try dividing them by, instead of 2, 3, 5, 7, all the way up to y, try dividing by just, say, 2 and 3. Numbers that have some 2s and 3s in them are more likely to be smooth. If you divide out the 2s and 3s, they'll have smaller unfactored pieces, which are more likely to be smooth with respect to the other primes than just completely random numbers. Well, you take all of the partial factorizations, take the unfactored parts of your numbers, and just keep the smallest ones. Just as at the beginning we kept the smallest numbers because those are most likely to be smooth, after you've done some trial divisions, you do an early abort and just keep the numbers that are apparently most likely to be smooth after that. And then complete the job for those numbers. Do complete factorizations using all the primes less than or equal to y. Well, complete, I mean, they're still just using primes less than or equal to y, but you finish the job up to y, and that tells you out of the numbers that were kept here, which of them are smooth. So you do a final abort of the non-smooth numbers. Let me be a little more precise about how expensive this is if you balance the stages here. Let's assume that both of the factorizations are done with trial division. I'm going to have several more methods of finding small primes through this talk. You've already heard about some methods. I'm going to cover those and some even better ones. Let's assume for the moment we're just using trial division, then to partially factor a number to divide out all the primes less than or equal to the square root of y takes about square root of y time, as compared to dividing all the way up to y takes about y time. You can balance those stages by, remember that we're not taking every congruence and factoring it using the primes less than or equal to y. We're only taking the ones that survive this early abort. After you've factored a number up to y to the 1/2, which takes times square root of y, basically, we then maybe keep it, and if we keep it, we then do y operations. Suppose that we keep only 1 over square root of y, or square root of y divided by y, is the way that these numbers come from the previous numbers. Suppose we take suppose the early abort, we keep this fraction of the congruences. Then that balances the time for the first partial factorization with the time for the second partial factorization. We do a first step that takes time square root of y to find all these primes of all the congruences. And then we keep only 1 over square root of y of the congruences. And for those, we spend time y, which overall is y divided by square root of y plus the first square root of y. So maybe the total time here is double the time for the without early aborts. We've reduced the time spent per congruence from about y to about square root of y. We've reduced the trial division cost by a square root of y factor. Now, this is not, the exponent here is not something obvious. The intuition here is that if you have a smooth number, it's more likely to survive the abort than a random number. All the congruences, we only kept 1 over square root of y of them. But here's a fact, which is like the u to the minus u fact, that this ends up keeping something like 1 over the 4th root of y of the smooth congruences. Assuming these are uniform random numbers, which It's just a conjecture that the numbers in the Q sieve, et cetera, behave like uniform random numbers. But in, say, Dixon's method, you can prove this. The random squares method, you can prove this. Anyway, without worrying about what we can prove, it is true that the percentage of Y smooth numbers that are kept by this early board is substantially larger than the fraction of all the congruences that are kept. It's about the fourth root, one out of every fourth root of Y. So that means if you take, let's see, if you take instead of Y squared congruences, suppose you take Y to the 2.25 congruences, then you're going to lose this factor, you're going to lose Y to the 0.25 out of them and be left with effectively Y squared congruences. Well, compared to the, if you start with Y to the 2.25 congruences, something like Y to the 1.25 of them will be smooth, and then those have chance Y to the minus 0.25 of surviving the early abort, which gives about a Y, or Y over log Y, more than Y over log Y, smooth congruences. If you balance the parameters appropriately, you'll get enough smooth congruences starting from Y to the 2.25 of them. And the time to handle those Y to the 2.25 is the trial division time is only square root of Y now, times Y to the 2.25. So that's Y to the 2.75. The price performance ratio here is improving by a Y to the 1/4, Y to the 0.25 power. Instead of Y cubed operations, it's Y to the 2.75 operations to find enough smooth numbers. Here's an example. In these talks, I'm giving basically no credit, but Andrew Schell is a student, so okay, not my student, because a student who did this computation wrote some software to figure out some early abort parameters, and here's a concrete example. Suppose you have numbers up to 2 to the 64, which is much smaller than cutting-edge factorization, but you can actually do these computations for much bigger sizes. Suppose you have a random number, uniform means every integer is equally likely, between 1 and 2 to the 64 minus 1, then what's the chance that it's Y smooth, where Y is 2 to the 15th? Well, it's about 2 to the minus 8, 2 to the minus 8.1. What's the chance that it has, after you divide out the primes up to 2 to the 7th, about square root of Y, what's the chance that the remaining part of it is below 2 to the 44th? Well, if it's not necessarily Y smooth, the chance for all possible integers in this range is about 2 to the minus 3.5. It's about, what is that, 1/10 chance of having a relatively small part that remains after you divide out the primes up through 128. If it's smooth, and you ask what's the chance of something smooth and it has a relatively small unfactored part after you divide out 2, 3, 5, and so on up to 128, well, the chance is better than 2 to the minus 8.1 times 2 to the minus 3.5. The chance of a smooth number having small unfactored parts surviving the early abort that'll happen is about 2 to the minus 9.8. So, if you start from a congruence, you factor it up to 2 to the 7th, and then you throw it away if the remaining part is bigger than 2 to the 44th, and then you complete the smoothness test, finding primes up to 2 to the 15th, only on the remaining numbers, then, well, this is going to throw away some smooth numbers that got unlucky, and their unfactored parts were too big, but it throws away many more of the non-smooth numbers. And overall, it improves the price-performance ratio by, let's see here, overall speeds things up by about a factor of 10, and it loses some of the smooth numbers, but not as many, so overall it's a gain of something like 2 to the 1.8. That comes from adding and subtracting the previous exponents in a sensible way. The 2 to the 3.5, that's the same 2 to the minus 3.5 you see there, inverted 2 to the 1.7, that's the difference between the 8.1 and 9.8 is 1.7, and 1.8 is 3.5 minus 1.7. And this is something like the fourth root of Y. Asymptotically, it's an improvement by the fourth root of Y.
Yeah?
Yeah.
2 to the 44th determined.
Well, that was just one example.
Right.
Now, that one was designed among powers of 2 to, Schell's software actually optimizes among the powers of 2, although he was optimizing for something fancier than trial division, namely rho, which you've heard about and I'll review later. And for rho, this was the best choice of parameter to speed that up. It's not the best for trial division. If you play with the 2 to the 44, you can get even better improvements at the end of the day. This doesn't really balance the stages in the way that I said before. It's something on the same scale. You can't really see how to optimize the the numbers when they're all so small. You have to look at much bigger numbers to get a feeling for it. But this is something where you can imagine doing this computation, trying numbers up to 2 to the 64, and actually used a much more subtle method of doing the computation more quickly. But anyway, the end result is for this particular parameter, which I'm not claiming is very well optimized, it is well optimized for something a little different from what I'm saying here. And I think I've answered your question.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so this next slide saying, instead of just doing one early abort, you can do multiple early aborts. The description of early aborts I've given so far is using one or two or any number of large primes with a single large prime cutoff. You can have many cutoffs for different sizes of large primes. In general, you abort at, let's say, a geometric progression. Instead of square root of y and y, you could have the third root of y and the two-thirds root of y and then y, or fourth root and then half root and then three-quarters root and so on. In general, if you work out the smoothness probabilities, then what you see is, okay, if you take time to trial divide up to y to the 1 over k, that's going to be, ignoring the smoothness probabilities for the moment, just the time involved for doing early abort trial division, you take time y to the 1 over k, say y to the 1/10, to do some initial trial division up to y to the 1/10, and then go up to y to the 2/10, but only on the best fraction 1 out of every y to the 1/10. That balances the time for trial dividing up to y to the 2/10 with the time for trial dividing up to y to the 1/10. You throw away most of your numbers so that the next stage of trial division is balanced with the first stage, and then you throw away, you just keep the best 1 out of every y to the 1/10 of what's left and do trial division up to y to the 3/10 and keep going. Overall, the cost ends up being like 10 times y to the 1/10 instead of y. The smoothness probabilities, well, if you have a smooth number, it has a relatively good chance, a pretty good chance of surviving this. That's intuitively clear that a smooth number should have lots more small factors than a non-smooth number. But working out exactly what happens, this divided by 2 here is not something obvious. It's something that follows from an analysis by Pomerantz that it's asymptotically the gain in cost divided by 2 is your gain in overall price performance ratio. The time drops from y cubed to find enough smooth congruences down to y to the 3 minus this thing. Which, depending on what k is, well, you can see here, the bigger you make k, the more effective this is. If k is really big, this is basically y to the 1/2. Instead of a gain of y to the 1/4, we have a gain of y to the 1/2. So you let k get bigger and bigger, depending on how big y is. There's some reasonably large optimum for k. And you can convince yourself with enough analysis. I'm not saying that the exponents here are obvious, but it is an experimental and, to some extent, theoretical fact that the time to find enough smooth congruences drops from y cubed down to y to the 2.5 with earlier board trial division. This ends up looking at y to the 2.5 congruences and spending very little time for each congruence, doing a whole lot of early aborts, and then finding out of that only y smooth congruences out of the y to the 1.5 that you would expect from y to the 2.5 congruences. Okay, this is getting halfway from y cubed to the goal of y squared. Actually, you might say goal is even better than y squared, but the best anybody has is on the scale of y squared. It would be nice to have something better than y to the 2.5. At this point, let me review what most descriptions of the quadratic sieve, number field sieve, and so on will tell you about finding smooth numbers. They'll say, okay, you don't bother with trial division, because if you look at I times n plus I, it's very easy to skip through the I's that have I times n plus I being divisible by p. And this is an example of sieving. Sieving, if you want to apply it, as I'll go through in detail, to the Q sieve, or more generally quadratic sieve, number field sieve, but I'll stick to the Q sieve for simplicity. You can understand all these techniques in this context. Sieving is going to take only about y squared bit operations to find y smooth congruences. What I mean is find enough smooth congruences, smooth being y smooth. Out of y squared congruences, you can find all the small prime factors of those in time, something like y squared, instead of y cubed or y to the 2.5. How sieving works is, there's lots of ways to phrase it. I like to think of it as a sorting question. What you're trying to find is for each I, you're trying to find which p's, which primes p divide I times n plus I. And then, okay, you might have to divide by them repeatedly, but only for a few product that divide I times n plus I. So the notation here is saying pz, that's a set of multiples of p, p being a prime, is I times n plus I in that set of multiples of p. Does p divide I times n plus I? Well, we're trying to find for each I which p is divided. Trial division says for each I, go through the possibilities for p. Sieving reverses that, goes through each p, and figures out which i's have I times n plus I being a multiple of p, which might sound like just as much effort, except that for each p, you only have to look at the i's that are multiples of p. So for each p, you write down all the pairs I comma p such that I times n plus I is a multiple of p, and I is between 1 and y squared. Explicitly, here are those pairs. For each p, there's p comma p, 2p comma p. Each I that's a multiple of p has I times n plus I, certainly multiple of p. And then also if n plus I is a multiple of p, which boils down to I is p minus n mod p, or 2p minus n mod p, 3p minus n mod p, and so on, those pairs are exactly the pairs I comma p where p divides I times n plus I. I have an example which continues on the next slide of exactly what sieving does. If y is, say, 10 and n is 6, 11, so we're trying to find the small factors of 1 times 6, 11 plus 1 and 2 times 6, 11 plus 2, and so on up to 100 times 6, 11 plus 100. Well, for the prime 2, you say, which of the i's are divisible by 2? Answer is 2, 4, 6, etc. up to 100. That's the second line of this slide here. You also ask which i's have n plus I being divisible by 2. The answer is 1, 3, 5, etc. up through 99. N being odd, well, okay, that's the other numbers that are divisible by 2. I times n plus I is always divisible by 2. Okay, maybe that wasn't so informative. But as the primes get bigger, sieving becomes more and more interesting. For the prime 3, which i's are multiples of 3? Well, 3, 6, etc. up to 99. You stop at 100. And then which n plus i's, which i's have n plus I being a multiple of 3? Well, if I is 1, for instance, then 6, 11 plus 1 is 6, 12, which sounds to me like multiple of 3. Add up the digits, 6 plus 1 plus 2 is 9, or just divide it by 3 in your head. And then 4 and 7 and 10 and so on. This is fewer pairs that I'm writing down. As the prime gets bigger, the basic advantage of sieving over trial division is that as the prime gets bigger, it writes down fewer and fewer pairs for the prime. It doesn't have to think about most I comma p's. It's just thinking about the pairs I comma p where I or n plus I is a multiple of p. For p equals 5, well, here's 5, 10, 15, etc. through 100, have those are multiples of 5, and then more interestingly, 4, 9, 14, 19, and so on, those have, if you add 6, 11 to them, they're multiples of 5, and then here's the same thing for 7. Having easily generated all of these pairs, you then sort them into order. And while I just went back and forth and sorted them into order, 1, 2, 1, 3, you can see those pairs on the left somewhere. And 2, 2, 3, 2, 3, 3, etc., all the way through 98, 2, 98, 7, and so on. Last one's 100, comma 5. From this list, you easily deduce, this is another way to express that table that I was showing at the beginning last time, you easily see which values of I times n plus I are divisible by which primes p. Excuse me, for instance, for 98, 98, comma 2, 98, comma 7, those have been sorted, collected together, which tells you that for I equals 98, the primes, the small primes that divide 98 are 2 and 7. As I wrote down here, the 2, 7 for I equals 98, that's just 98, 2, 98, 7. You can scan through this list, and when you get to 98, you see from the sorted list that 2 and 7 divide 98 times n plus 98, and then divide 98 times n plus 98 by 2s and 7s until you've completely factored it. You don't have to bother dividing by 3, 4, 5. It might seem like the savings here is not too big, and that's just because we're looking at such small primes. Let's look at the asymptotics as we have bigger and bigger examples. If you have I going from 1 through y squared, or y could be really big, then out of those y squared pairs, how many of them are multiples of p? Well, how many of the pairs? How many of the i's between 1 and y squared are multiples of p? Well, about 1 over p of p, 2p, 3p, etc., up to y squared over, well, up to whatever the multiple of p is around y squared, there's about y squared over p of those pairs. And also there's the n plus I being divisible by p, so that's another y squared over p pairs. Each prime p produces about 2y squared over p pairs. The total number of those is the sum for primes p less than or equal to y of 2y squared over p. And I think you've already heard that the sum of 1 over p for primes p less than or equal to y is about log log y. That's why it gets big. So very, very small. Basically, the number of pairs is y squared times some very small extra stuff, a 2 and a log log y. So that's not too much work to write down all these pairs. If you want to sieve, to detect smoothness, to find all the prime factors of I times n plus I, and then divide them out and see which ones are smooth, then, well, the time to generate pairs is just for each p. You write down some easy multiples of p. You have to do some division of n by p, but that's not a serious concern. If you work out the time for that, it fits in the time bound, I'll say, down here. Sorting is also something that takes essentially linear time. I think that was the first algorithm speed-up example you heard last week. Checking the smoothness of the numbers, once you know which primes to try dividing by, then it takes very little time to divide out powers of those primes until you get down to something not divisible by the primes. There's very few primes that divide any particular number. So the total cost here, you work it out, you get something a little bigger than y squared. I've been a little fuzzy about exactly how big it is. Log y to the power of big O of 1. Log y to the power of some constant. What's important compared to the y squared, we've gotten down from y cubed to y squared times something very small. The number of operations per congruence to find all the small prime factors, small being less than or equal to y, and to detect smoothness, is only a power of log y. Even if y is very big, depending on what the power is, that does not scale very badly. It's something that, as y gets bigger and bigger, log y only grows very slowly, and so the cost here scales well compared to the y squared congruences we're looking for. At this point, the textbooks give up and say, well, you can sieve, and it takes time y squared, and every method we know looks at least y squared congruences, so that's the end of the story. But in fact, what people do is much more complicated. They don't just sieve. They use, for instance, large primes, in other words, early aborts, and in practice get very complicated with combinations of early aborts, sieving, and the other techniques that I'm going to tell you about. One of the reasons people don't use sieving, one of the reasons that sieving, in a simple way I've expressed it, is not what people do in large factorizations, is that sieving has to look at a whole bunch of consecutive i's. Sieving is, at heart, figuring out efficiently which i's have I divisible by p, and which i's have n plus I divisible by p. You can skip quickly through the i's where I is divisible by p or n plus I is. You can do the same for, say, I squared. In the quadratic sieve, I squared minus n is the replacement for I times n plus I. And that has the same feature, that you can efficiently figure out for any particular prime p, which i's have I squared minus n divisible by p. Same problem you heard about earlier today of figuring out what are the square roots of the number mod p. That's an easy computation to do, not that I'm going to tell you how to do it. You've actually heard about polynomial factorization very efficiently, I believe, last week, and, well, that's the same problem. In any case, sieving can handle i's that are consecutive integers, I times n plus i's that are, that's a quadratic polynomial in I, or general quadratics, or any low-degree polynomial is good. But if you remember what I said about sublattices, which definitely improves the Q-sieve, and something similar improves the number field sieve, all these other algorithms, then i's are no longer consecutive. You can have some consecutive i's, but sublattices tell you, actually, you get smaller numbers by not having consecutive i's, by switching to some different Q was the word I use for describing the variable for sublattices. And, well, sieving is in conflict with sublattices. Sieving really insists that you use at least something like y, consecutive numbers. That you look at I times n plus I, where the i's are in some arithmetic progression, where the length of the arithmetic progression is at least something like y. If you have something, say, 10 times smaller than y, that makes sieving 10 times slower. So you really don't want to go below y. On the other hand, you really do want to go below y for sublattices. Sublattices, well, turning this around into, if you insist on sieving, then you can't do a whole lot of sublattices. You can do at most y sublattices instead of the y squared that you would like to do. So the smoothness chance of your numbers, your congruences are bigger than they would otherwise be because you use sieving, which forces you to look at a lot of consecutive eyes, you have a lower smoothness chance of your numbers than you would like. There's a fix for this. There's a way to completely eliminate this problem of having to have consecutive values of a polynomial, like I times n plus I, consecutive values of a low degree polynomial, which is remainder trees. Let me start with product trees. I'm going to just look at y numbers at the same time. For sieving, I said, well, you can split y squared numbers into just look at y numbers at a time. That's a, sort of an easy reduction to do. It definitely saves space to look at just y numbers at a single moment. And same thing here. I'm just going to look at y congruences, C1 through Cm, where m is something like y. Let's assume we have a bunch of, well, for everything I'll say, these are just positive integers, C1 through Cm. You can also deal with negative. Throw away the minus sign. Each of which has something like log y bits, or, well, let's just say the total is y times some power of log y bits. As usual, log is log base, lg is log base 2, and the big O of 1 is some power, say, 3. Doesn't matter for what I'm going to say. You can multiply them all together in time y times some power of log y, not necessarily the same power. Actually, it's the same power plus 1 or 2, depending on how careful you are. This is something that relies on fast arithmetic. You heard about the speed of doing arithmetic last week. You heard that, well, the simple way to multiply numbers takes quadratic time. And it's essential for this result that you use the fast Fourier transform. Do fast arithmetic, which takes essentially linear time to multiply two big numbers. Here I'm multiplying a bunch of small numbers. And the relationship between multiplying the small ones and multiplying the big ones is with product trees. Well, here's this recursive definition, but let me just show you the example. Here is the product tree for six numbers, 23, 29, 84, 15, 58, 19. You just take pairs of the numbers and multiply them together, and, well, if you look at the ceilings and floors of M over 2 there, then you can see exactly which ways to multiply them together. Form a kind of balanced tree. For six numbers, you can't have it exactly balanced, but basically, as few levels as possible, multiply together a pair of numbers. What I said in the definition there is the product tree, you take on the left, you take the first half of the numbers, to be precise, up to the ceiling of m over 2, where m is the number of integers here. And then on the right, you take the other half, multiply them together recursively. So slightly left skewed maybe, but multiply 23 and 29, that gives you 667, multiply by 84. Meanwhile, multiply 15 by 58, giving you 870, multiply by 19, gives 16,530, then multiply the numbers on top, and you get whatever that big number is, the product of all the original numbers. Every level of this tree, you work your way up from the bottom, every level of this tree you figure out, you compute by multiplying some numbers on the level below. How long does that take? Well, you've heard that multiplying two numbers with the fast Fourier transform, multiplying two big numbers, look at the top level, for example, the 56,000 and 16,000. Imagine million-digit numbers there. Multiplying a couple of million-digit numbers will take you something like a million operations. Okay, there's an extra log factor here, but the asymptotic performance we have, the Schoenhage-Strassen theorem, tells you that multiplying two b-bit numbers takes b log b times some small constant bit operations. So basically, a logarithmic factor more than the size, the total size of the numbers you're dealing with. And that's true for each level of the tree, that the time to multiply two numbers is essentially the volume of the numbers times some log factor. And there's only a logarithmic number of levels of the tree, so there's an extra log factor. But log factors are small, they scale well. So the total time to compute the product of a bunch of little numbers is essentially linear in the volume of the numbers.
What's the volume of the numbers?
Well, just the length, the number of digits, number of bits in the numbers. Okay, going from top down with division instead of from bottom up with multiplication, you get remainder trees. The objective here now is to compute one big number, big P, modulo a bunch of little numbers, C1, C2 through Cm. The remainder tree of all those numbers, P is special here, and the C1 through Cm are kind of at the bottom, like in a product tree. Well, you take the big number mod each of the nodes in the product tree. And, well, again, let's just look at the example here. If you have P is 2, 2, 3, 0, 9, etc., and then these six C's are the same as in the product tree before, then 2, 2, 3, 0, 9, 2, 8, 7, 0 mod, the top of the product tree over there is the top of the remainder tree. And 22309287O mod 56028 is 45402. And mod 16530 is 3990. 22309287O mod 19 is 0. Mod 15 is 0. Mod 58 is 46, and so on. Now, if you actually want to compute the bottom here, the objective of remainder trees is to compute pmod c1, pmod c2, and so on through pmod cm. That would sound like a quadratic time computation if you kept reading through, say, y bits of a number. If p has y bits, and you divide it by y little numbers, then that's going to take you y squared operations. To take p mod a little y requires reading through p, which is y operations, and then p mod another number. If you have y numbers, it's y squared operations. The remainder tree does not compute all those separately. What it does is it computes them by first computing p mod a product, and then knowing, say, p mod 870 is 510, you don't have to go back to p to figure out p mod 15 is 0. You just have to look at 510 mod 15. If you take p mod a product and n mod one of the factors, that's the same as p mod one of the factors. So the remainder tree recursively uses the idea that p mod a and p mod b are both easily deducible from p mod ab. With just take p mod ab, take that small number mod a, and that small number mod b. As in the case of the product tree, well, you can work out the complexity here, and it's something essentially linear in the total size. Basically, you just look at the total volume of the numbers here, and that's how long the divisions take. All right, let's apply this to smoothness detection. Let's figure out of a bunch of numbers, which ones are smooth. There's no need now for the numbers to be consecutive I times n plus i's or consecutive values of a polynomial. They're just arbitrary, C1 through Cm. Let's apply the remainder tree where the big P is a product of all the primes less than or equal to y. Remember that the time to compute the product tree is what's the total volume of all the primes less than or equal to y. There's about y over log y primes, each of which has log y bits, so it's a total of y bits in the primes. The time to multiply them all together, if you do it recursively with fast multiplication in half-size batches, you end up with the product tree in time y times log, say, y times log squared. And similarly, you can compute the remainder tree. Whatever the C1, C2, and so on are, if there's about y bits total in those C's, then you can compute this big number. P is like, say y is a billion. P is a billion digits long. And each C, there's maybe a billion C's, each of which is one digit long. And, well, maybe not one digit, say 10 digits long. You compute P mod each of those relatively small numbers with a remainder tree in, again, essentially linear time, something like y times the power of log y time. And then once you know P mod C1, once you know the product of a bunch of primes mod some C1, it's really easy to figure out if C1 is smooth. Well, C1 is smooth if and only if it divides P, that's not exactly right. If it divides P to some big power. Question?
Yeah. With the C1s through C, however many, are they just arbitrary, or do you have special ways to pick them?
These are arbitrary. So these are the congruences. I mean, in the context of the Q sieve, these could be C1 is 1 times n plus 1, and C2 is 2 times n plus 2, and so on. Now, that's maybe easier to handle with sieving. But if you then take the Q sieve with sublattices, then suddenly C1 might be, remember that relatively complicated formula of you take, you find some Q that's a square of a large prime, and then you take I to be, Q minus N mod Q, and then take I times N plus I divided by Q. And that's something that's not, well, it's relatively random looking. That could be as Q varies. Those could be the different C's. It's for different choices of Q what your generalized congruences are that you would like to have being smooth. And similarly, in the quadratic sieve, when you throw in sublattices, you get relatively random-looking numbers. So these could be arbitrary. The algorithm works for any C's. In the context of the Q sieve, these C's would be, they could be as simple as C sub I is I times N plus I, but then when you generalize, they're not going to be such simple consecutive values of a polynomial. They'll be the sublattice generalized polynomial. Okay. So it's true that C1 is smooth if it divides a big power of P. And the power that you need is, well, however big, how big could a power of 2, say, be in C1? Well, it's at most whatever 2 to the k fits into C1. If 2 to the 2 to the k is strictly bigger than C1, then there's no way to have a 2 to the kth power of 2 or any other prime and C1. So if C1 is smooth and you choose K so that every prime to the 2 to the K is bigger than C1, then if C1 is smooth, it has to divide P to the 2 to the K, where P is the product of all the primes. All the exponents in C1, if C1 is 2 to the something, 3 to the something, all the somethings are less than 2 to the K, that's the same as saying C1 divides 2 to the K, 3 to the 2 to the K, et cetera, which is P to the 2 to the K. So from P mod C1, you compute the K, 2 to the kth power of that mod C1 by K squarings. K is very small. It's double logarithmic in the size of C1. So it's very fast to compute P to the 2 to the K mod C1. And if you get 0, you know that C1 is Y smooth. And then do the same thing separately for each of the C's. You figure out which of the C's are smooth. As in the case of sieving, the total number of operations here for handling Y numbers is Y times some power of log Y. And then if you wanted Y squared numbers, it would be Y squared times power of log Y. You could just apply the same algorithm, or you could do Y batches of applying the same algorithm. This is about, if you don't look in more detail at what the big O of 1 is, it's about the same speed as sieving. And it doesn't require that the C's be consecutive values of a polynomial. But unfortunately, it doesn't fix the other problem with sieving. Remainder trees and sieving both have the annoying feature that you need a huge amount of memory. You need something like Y bits of storage. Maybe not RAM, maybe this is disk, but you need a ton of memory, which if you count bit operations, you don't see. This hidden cost is not something that is a question of where do your C's come from, how are you optimizing the whole algorithm together. This is a deficiency in the cost model. Counting bit operations prevents you from seeing that some algorithms use a ton of memory and other algorithms use just a little bit of memory. The algorithms that use just a little bit of memory are better once you scale up to big computations. If Y is, say, 1,000, then okay, you don't care about 1,000 bits of storage. Your processor has 1,000 bits of very, very fast storage, level 1 cache. When I say fast memory, you might think there's fast memory and slow memory. In fact, computers have several levels. There's a storage hierarchy where the fastest would be level 1 cache, which you can access in a couple of cycles. Well, really the fastest is registers. There's a very small amount of registers that are very, very fast to access. And then there's level 1 cache, maybe 16 kilobytes of an Athlon, 64 kilobytes of level 1 cache. It's never very big, 64 kilobytes, not megabytes. This is a very small amount of memory, which you can access in a few cycles. And then there's level 2 cache, maybe half a megabyte of level 2 cache, which is also kind of expensive, not so fast. It takes maybe 10 cycles to access. And then there's RAM, dynamic RAM, which is this glacial memory that eventually gives you back your results. After hundreds of cycles, you end up retrieving data from RAM, but that might be, say, megabytes, or even gigabytes of RAM. And then there's disk. The access time for disk is really, really big. But there's lots of it. There's many gigabytes. I've got some machines that have hundreds of gigabytes of storage, and there's lots of people who have terabytes of disk. And well, it's very slow, but there's a whole lot of it. If you have a computation where Y is, say, a billion or a trillion, imagine Y is 2 to the 40, suddenly storing 2 to the 40 bits of data, as you're required to do for these algorithms, means you have to pay, well, real dollars to buy the disks, and then you have to pay in your time for accessing the disks. Communication is expensive. You can't have a whole lot of fast memory if you pay attention to the cost of your computer. You might have a whole lot of slow memory. But if you do a gigantic computation, okay, if you have a computation that fits into level 1 cache, fits into your fastest memory, then you're not going to notice the communication cost, the time to access memory. But if you scale your computations up, you start doing computations on big data that maybe even doesn't fit on one computer. Record-setting factorizations will use a whole big pile of computers. People are talking about computations using billions of parallel CPUs for factorization. And in that context, you cannot ignore the cost of memory. You cannot ignore the time that it takes to access a huge bank of Y bits of memory. So the question I'll address in the rest of the talk is, how do we avoid using a ton of memory? Suppose you just want your computation to fit into, say, 64 kilobytes of level 1 cache, or you could try to balance the memory use against other factors, but remember that that's nowhere near as big as Y. Y is scaling up to a huge value, say 2 to the 40. You don't have a lot of memory. You can't use sieving. You can't use remainder trees. Maybe you could use them as the first stage in an early abort. You could use them up to square root of Y. But then you have to figure out what to do next. And, well, let me tell you the things you can do next. One of them that you've heard about already is the row method. It takes very little storage if you do it in the most obvious way. Let's define row sub 0 is 0. Row sub 1 is row 0 squared plus 11. Sounds like 11. Row 2 is row 1 squared plus 11. 11 squared plus 11. And so on. Keep squaring and adding 11, which doubles the number of digits every time. I'm not suggesting at any moment that you actually write down row sub 7150, for example, which has a ridiculous number of digits in it. But we'll work around that. Here's a fact, which I checked, not by writing down the number, that every prime less than or equal to 2 to the 20th, prime equal to 2 to the 20th, well, okay. Every prime less than or equal to y, where y is 2 to the 20th, is a divisor of row 1 minus row 2 times row 2 minus row 4 times row 3 minus row 6, and so on through row 3575 minus row 7150. There were a couple of working primes that waited until that point to be divisors of this product. And there's also many more primes. I don't mean to suggest that S is just the product of the small primes, as in the previous algorithms we were looking at. This is a product that's divisible by all the primes up to a million, 2 to the 20th, and also divisible by many larger primes, so we kind of get bonus primes here. But let's just look at the primes up to 2 to the 20th. They're all divisors of this number. Now, I claim you can efficiently compute the greatest common divisor of any congruent C you're trying to find the small factors of, and this S. It takes only about 2 to the 14, only some thousands of multiplications mod C, and very little memory. You never have to write down a big number bigger than C, because you just compute each of the rows mod C. You start from row 1. Well, let's forget about the minus parts here. Compute row 1, row 2, row 3, and so on through row 3575 mod C by just squaring the previous result, adding 11, reducing modulo C, so now I have a number smaller than C again. C is a tiny number, maybe 100 digits might be a congruence in these factoring algorithms. So you do 3575 squarings for that, and then at the same time, you compute row 2, row 4, row 6, etc., not trying to look for sort of save all your rows, because that would take a lot of memory. Just compute on the side row 1, row 2, row 3, row 4, row 5, row 6, and so on through 7150. So overall, something like, what, 10,000 squarings mod C. That's about what I said here. Very little memory. Again, you're just working with, at each moment, a couple of numbers modulo C and squaring them, reducing mod C. And this is about the same speed as trial division for the same result. If you trial divide up to 2 to the 20th, it takes more divisions. But on the other hand, they're divisions by small numbers. If you work out the speeds of multiplication and division or just try it out, this is something on the same scale of time. And it's a different method that scales better. If you look at larger values of y, then you might choose z sensibly. In the middle of the slide, I come back to how big z has to be. Instead of z being 3575, go up to row z minus row 2z for any z. And then question, instead of that computation model, the primes up to 2 to the 20th, suppose you look at all the primes up to y. How big does your z have to be for all the primes less than or equal to y to divide this big number s? Which, by the way, if you do want to check, you can do it by this computation of each try c being each of the primes in order. But without even bothering doing the computation, let's just estimate how long would you need to go, how big does the z have to be, and there's about 3z squarings here, how big does z have to be until you get all the primes up to y? Well, the reasonable conjecture here is it's only about square root of y. Z, if z is around square root of y, so you only have to do 3 times the square root of y, multiplications mod c, then you get all the primes up to y. Maybe it's a little bigger than that. Maybe z should be, to be precise here, maybe this should be square root of y times log y. But it's basically square root of y. Y to the 1/2 plus something that converges to 0. As opposed to y, which was the rough scale for trial division. Maybe square root of y times log y versus trial division was y divided by log y. Maybe for small values of y, you don't see the advantage. Like here, it's about the same speed. But as y gets bigger and bigger, this is square root instead of the first power. Even better, if you combine it with early aborts, then you end up taking, instead of y cubed operations total, or y to the 2.5 that I had before, this gets down to y to the 2.25 bit operations to find enough smooth congruences. The reason for the square root of y, this is what you heard last week, I believe, about cycles and random naps. That this squaring plus 11 looks like a random nap. Well, if you vary the 11, then I think you heard if you have 11 being random, then at least you can prove for the first logarithmic number of these steps that they're sufficiently random to have something like this being true. That if you look at these numbers, they're kind of like successive values of a random function. Certainly these rho 1 mod p, rho 2 mod p, et cetera, there's at most p different values until you find a collision. But if you iterate the function being squaring plus 11 mod p, if you iterate that and it looks sufficiently random, then actually after only square root of p, or what is it, square root of pi p over 2 is the usual number people quote, heuristically, the squaring plus 11 is enough like a random map that you will find after only about square root of p, on average, square root of pi p over 2 steps of this, you will find a collision, say rho I mod p is rho j mod p, where I is less than j, and then that guarantees that you'll find one of these rho z minus rho 2z or something in between rho k minus rho 2k being a multiple of p, where k is the smallest multiple of j minus I bigger than I and bigger than j, which is not much bigger than I and j overall. It's almost about double I and j. So I and j, you're going to find your first collision. Again, we can't really prove this, but experimentally, you will find your first collision after only something like square root of p for an average p, only about square root of p iterations of squaring and adding 11 mod p, and that guarantees that if z is bigger than, say, 3 times the square root of p, then you'll have z being big enough. Okay, some p's will be unlucky, which is why z actually has to be square root of p or square root of y, p's go up to y, times a log factor to handle all the unlucky p's. But basically, it's square root of y performed. Another method you heard about is the p minus 1 method. The overall goal, once you've realized that, okay, with not as many operations as in trial division, you can write down a big number s that has lots of small prime factors, then you might be inspired to try to write down a big number s that has lots of small prime factors with fewer multiplications. In this case, the heuristic argument, and certainly if you try it out, says that with something like 3 square root of y multiplications, you get most of the primes up to y. If you go a bit further, all the primes up to y. Well, does it have to be square root of y? The answer is no. The p minus 1 method is an illustration of how quickly you can find some primes up to y, and then we'll push this further and see how quickly you can find all the primes. The basic idea, I think you also saw this formula last week, is you choose a number z, and instead of having some complicated squaring plus 11 and take differences of those and multiply them together, you just take a power of 2. You take 2 to the power of the least common multiple of 1 through z. Say z is 20. Least common multiple of 1 through 20. It's some nine-digit number. I'll look at it in a moment. Take 2 to that power minus 1. This is something else that you can compute reasonably quickly, modulo any given c, because taking a big power of 2, even if it's a gigantic power, the number of squarings, multiplications you need, mod c, is just the number of bits in the exponent. How many bits are in this least common multiple? I'll get to that in a moment. It's not too much bigger than z. So computing s1, even though s1 is a gigantic number, z gets really big, computing s1 mod c is really easy. And now the point of this power of 2, why this s1 is divisible by lots of little primes, is that if this least common multiple of 1 through z is a multiple of p minus 1, then s1 is guaranteed, maybe I should have said if p is an odd prime here, then s1 is guaranteed to be a multiple of p. Because, well, you take 2 to the power of a multiple of p minus 1, 2 to the p minus 1 is 1 mod p, if p is odd, and then subtracting 1 from it, well, taking 2 to the any multiple of p minus 1 is still 1 mod p, subtracting 1 from it, you get a multiple of p. So s1 is divisible by all of the p's, all of the primes p, where p minus 1 divides this least common multiple. And this least common multiple of a bunch of little numbers, well, it's divisible by not just those numbers, but also by a product of those numbers. And there's actually lots of possibilities for p that have p minus 1 dividing the least common multiple. You can play with this method in various ways. There's what's called a stage 2, but, well, it doesn't really change the algorithm. I'll just skip past that paragraph. Example for z equals 20. The least common multiple of 1 through 20 is 2, 3, 2, 7, 9, 2, 5, 6, 0. 16 times 9 times 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19. You take all the prime powers that are up through 20, take the biggest power of each prime, less than or equal to 20, multiply those all together, and there's the least common multiple. 2 to that power, okay, it's a gigantic number, but you can compute it with only 34 multiplications by squaring repeatedly and occasionally multiplying by 2. And the time to do that, actually I didn't count out of these 34 multiplications which ones were squarings and which ones were very easy multiplications by 2. In any case, you can do those squarings mod C and figure out S1 mod C. And if C has any of the prime divisors listed here, the prime divisors of S1, then they will show up as part of the greatest common divisor of S1 and C. S1 has all these prime divisors. Well, this is not every prime, but it's a whole lot of primes. There's maybe, are there any primes between 157 and 181? I think there are. And, well, those are not divisors of 2 to the 2, 3, 2, 7, 9, 2, 5, 6, 0, minus 1. But there are lots of primes that are divisors. And, well, there's so few multiplications required to compute this S1 that this is an interesting method of locating lots of primes. Again, the objective here is, can we write down a big number that you compute with multiplications, squarings, additions, subtractions, which has lots of prime divisors? So then if you compute that number mod C, you'll have lots of chances for it to have a factor in common with C. And S1 does a pretty good job. It certainly seems to have lots of prime divisors in it. Here's what happens if you scale this up. If Z is really big, the number of bits in the least common multiple of 1 through Z is about 1.44 times Z. That's something which, the 1.44 is some logarithm. This all comes from the prime number theorem again. I said that I wanted to find the p minus 1s that divide this least common multiple. That's about the same as asking for p minus 1 to be smooth, to be z smooth. There's two parameters here, the z and the y, two different smoothness parameters running around. Z is going to be much smaller than y. I have a formula for it in a moment. Z is much smaller than y. Y is much smaller than n, which we're ultimately trying to factor. Anyway, the smoothness comment is that if p minus 1 is z smooth, that's about the same as saying that p minus 1 divides that least common multiple of 1 through z. Maybe not exactly the same. It might have a huge power of 2 bigger than the least common multiple. But basically, your intuition about how likely numbers are to be z smooth is also how likely the numbers are to divide the least common multiple of 1 through z. And based on that intuition, the same kind of exponential square root log log with an appropriate 1/2, if z is chosen to be this e to the square root of log, then work out the smoothness chances and assume unjustifiably that p minus 1 is like a random number in how often it's smooth, then, and assume that smoothness is just like this least common multiple condition, then you see that for this value of z, what's the chance of a number up to y being z smooth? Well, this is just like the choice of y before in terms of n. And we chose that so that about 1 out of every y numbers is y smooth. Same for z here. Z is chosen with respect to y so that a random number up to y, like p minus 1, has about a 1 over z chance of being z smooth. And experimentally, this is true, that if you take z around this, then there's about a 1 over z chance of p minus 1 being z smooth. In other words, out of the primes up to y, you find 1 over z of them. Think of z as very small. So that's actually a noticeable chance of finding a prime with only, how many multiplications are there? I don't think I wrote it down here, but only something like, I did write it down, sorry, 1.44 times z, which is something sub-exponential in y. Only a very small number of multiplications, modulo c, to find a whole bunch of different primes. Not all the primes, by any means. Only 1 over z of the primes. But still, it's inspirational how fast this is, that it's much faster than a power of y. Considering how many primes it finds and how long it takes about z multiplications and finds 1 over z. Think of that as overall price-performance ratio of z squared, which is sub-exponential in y. It's a lot better than the square root of y we had before. But OK, how do we find other prime numbers? The next piece of the state-of-the-art algorithms for this is the P plus 1 method, where Williams said take V0 to be some number, V1 to be some other number, and it doesn't really matter the 11s and so on that I'm writing down and the 10 here. You could choose any number, but there's no reason to take more than one choice in light of the elliptic curve method, which I'm just about to, compute v2i as vi squared minus 2, and v2i plus 1, that's defined recursively as vi, vi plus 1 minus v1, if you think about how many v's you have to compute to get to v sub something big. You see, it's just logarithmic, just like computing an ith power, I, which for a moment might seem like, oops, 2i plus 1 depends on two previous values. And you compute two successive values at the same time. And then let's define S2, alternative to S1, as V sub, the same big number, least common multiple of 1 through Z, minus 2. These formulas are not supposed to be something obvious that this S2 gives you multiples of lots of little primes, because S2 has lots of prime divisors in it. But it's not too hard to prove that if you look at the ring, Z adjoin X mod X squared minus 10X plus 1, then these V's have a relatively simple interpretation in terms of X. It's X to the I plus X to the minus I. That's V sub I modulo this X squared minus 10X plus 1. Which implies that if you have this ring modulo P being a field, then the V sub I is going to be a, just like the 2 to the I before, this, think of this as like 2 to the I plus 2 to the minus I. It's something that, well, all right, here's the exact condition, has a good chance of being divisible by P. If you have a prime P where P plus 1 divides the least common multiple, and you have the discriminant 10 squared minus 4 being not a square modulo P, if you like, you can think about the quadratic field here. If you have P being inert, not splitting, not being ramified, if you have P having just one prime over it in the quadratic field Q adjoint alpha, where alpha is the root of this polynomial, if you have a prime P like that, which half of all primes are, and again, if P plus 1 divides the least common multiple, which some primes are, then the ring, this ring mod P, take FP, the field 0 through P minus 1 under usual operations, adjoin an alpha that satisfies alpha squared minus 10 alpha plus 1. That is a field which easily implies that this alpha to the I plus alpha to the minus I is 0 in that field. If you take P plus first power in a field of an element that has norm 1, you can read off lots of information from things you're learning about norms in quadratic fields, then you can see that the P plus first power is going to be 1, and that is enough to tell you that V sub I is 2, and therefore when you subtract 2 from it, S sub 2 is 0, modulo P. Okay, you can throw away the algebra once you believe that the method works, or just accept somebody else saying that, okay, here's the algebra for it. Just try writing down this S2, and you see, okay, if Z is 20, for instance, you write down V sub big number, which again takes very few multiplications, subtract 2 from it, then you get a number that has a ton of prime divisors. These are numbers where P plus 1 divides least common multiple of 1 through 20. Certainly, if P plus 1 divides that least common multiple, then you're guaranteed to get a P dividing S2. And if you look at this list and compare it to the previous list, you see some different primes showing up. This is P plus 1 being smooth is a somewhat different condition from P minus 1 being smooth. Again, smoothness is just an approximation to the final result here of whether S2 is divisible by P is not exactly the same as saying that P plus 1 is smooth, but it's something comparable. There's a lot of overlap between the conditions. They're close enough that your intuition for smoothness probabilities applies in this case as well. So P minus 1 finds something like 1 over Z of the primes in Z 1.44z multiplications, and the p plus 1 method finds another 1 over z of the primes, different primes, primes where p plus 1 divides this least common multiple, mostly different primes. The small ones are showing up in both, but as primes get bigger, then p minus 1 and p plus 1 are kind of independent. What about the other primes? Well, this brings us to the elliptic curve method. This is another case where if you are going to accept that somebody says, here's some magic numbers which have lots of prime divisors, and you try computing them, and you see, oh, wow, they do have lots of prime divisors, you don't need to know why they have lots of prime divisors to write down the formulas. The elliptic curve method, let's take A equals 6. Although, as you've heard, it's important to allow the elliptic curves here to vary. It's important to take some more choices of A, like A equals 10, 14, 18. But just for understanding, let's take A equals 6. then here's a recursive definition of two sequences, X sub I and V sub I. Again, these are not obvious formulas. How somebody came up with this, well, even after elliptic curves were well known, these formulas were not easy to come up with. But it's surprisingly simple formulas, actually, compared to a lot of the elliptic curve formulas out there. This is a recursive definition of x1, d1, x2, d2, x3, d3, and so on, which you can then evaluate at d sub, the least common multiple of 1 through 20, say, or least common multiple of 1 through z. Even if z is really big, even if this least common multiple is a gigantic number, z is a billion, the least common multiple is going to have 1.44 billion bits, you can still figure out d sub that gigantic number, because you just have to work backwards to d sub half of it, d sub half of it plus 1, x sub half of it, x sub half of it plus 1, and then a quarter and an eighth, and you rapidly get down to x sub 1 and d sub 1. This is an easy recursion to evaluate if you take the vector x2i, d2i, x2i plus 1, d2i plus 1 for just a few values of I, then, namely, this final value and that divided by 2's, take floors at each step. That's easily computed recursively. So S sub A is something that with just the multiplications and squarings you see here, with A equals 6 in the middle, you get S sub 6. And that is a number that I claim has lots of small prime divisors. All right, as you heard last week, the elliptic curve method gives you lots of these S's. There are lots of curves running around, lots of chances for a P, well, an order of an elliptic curve might be something like P minus 1, P plus 1, P plus something different. Lots of chances for those to be smooth, and actually every P ends up with one of these S's eventually, a bunch of S's eventually, having P as a divisor. Again, as you heard, the variability here, being able to choose not just S1, S2, S6, but also S10, S14, and so on, that improves the effectiveness of this method. Yeah?
Sequences have a name.
Do these sequences have a name? Well, I would guess that the D's are elliptic divisibility sequences, since you asked, but I'll get to...
What a leading question.
Yeah. Well, okay, so here's the algebraic structure of the D's, and then that makes it clear that the D's are denominators in elliptic curve point. All right, so here's a theorem. If you have the elliptic curve, here's the central algebraic object, there's a group running around, just like for the P minus 1 and P plus 1 methods, there's a group running around, the multiplicative group for the P minus 1 and the what's called the twisted multiplicative group for P plus 1, and here are some elliptic curve groups. The elliptic curve running around implicitly in these formulas is basically y squared equals x cubed plus ax squared plus x. I've multiplied the y squared by something so that I can easily write down a point 2 comma 1 on this curve, which incidentally is also the 2 comma 1 that shows up, 2 is the 2 divided by 1 here, and then also a 2 shows up as that 8 is 4 times 2 anyway. These are good enough formulas. You don't need to know more about how to generalize these. These are the fastest elliptic curve method formulas we have, all due to Montgomery. If you take this elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus ax squared plus x, and look at the ith multiple of 2 comma 1, it could be the point at infinity, or it could have x and y coordinates. And, well, if d sub I there is not a multiple of p, if you can do this division, xi divided by d sub I, modulo p, then it is a fact that this elliptic curve, if you multiply 2, 1 by I on the elliptic curve, you get xi divided by di and some y coordinate that you could write down, but you don't need it for what we're doing. If, on the other hand, di is a multiple of p, then, well, I'm not saying anything in that case. Maybe the 2, 1, maybe the ith multiple of 2, 1 is a point at infinity, or maybe it could be some other point. I believe there are examples where di is kind of accidentally a multiple of p without getting the point at infinity. I don't know how to prove it, and the computations I've done haven't found it. It'd be interesting. It's kind of like finding exceptions to tricky primality tests, which we can't prove work. But, well, anyway, all we need is this theorem, which is something that from the standard elliptic curve addition formulas, you can, with a fair amount of work, prove that these satisfy this condition. If d sub I is not a multiple of p, then this works. For d sub I being a multiple of p, what can go wrong is it's possible for xi and di to both be a multiple of p. If xi is not a multiple of p and di is a multiple of p, then the ith multiple of 2, 1 is a point at infinity, but it's possible for both xi and di to accidentally be multiples of p, as far as I know. Anyway, we don't need to worry about that case. What's important is if di is not a multiple of p, then the ith multiple of 2, 1 is this explicit formula, which is not the point at infinity. I also have a condition I wrote there that a squared minus 4 and 4a plus 10, those are not multiples of p. That's because I want to have this actually be an elliptic curve mod p. Otherwise, if p divides this particular number, a squared minus 4 or 4a plus 10, then oops, we don't have an elliptic curve. But okay, excluding the few primes p that divide this 6 squared minus 4 or 4 times 6 plus 10, whatever a is, there's just a few p's to worry about. For other p's, if you look at this elliptic curve, suppose you do get the point at infinity. For the ith multiple, where I is the least common multiple of 1 through z, suppose I is that LCM, you take I times 2, 1, and you get the point at infinity. In other words, I is a multiple of the order. Then d sub I cannot be a non-multiple of p. D sub I must be a multiple of p, because if it weren't a multiple of p, then by the elliptic curve formulas, you would not get the point at infinity. So if you do get the point at infinity, then d sub I, s sub a, must be a multiple of p. All right, so if this random number, that order, which is kind of like a p minus 1 or p plus 1 or the order of 2 modulo p, here we've got the order of 2, 1 in an elliptic curve group, if that order divides the least common multiple, basically if it's z smooth, then we get p as a divisor of s sub 6, s sub 10, whatever. The elliptic curve group, the order of the group, which is some typically small multiple of the order of any particular point, the order of the group, the number of points on the elliptic curve, as we've heard, is always between p plus 1 minus 2 root p and p plus 1 plus 2 root p. It's something like p minus 1 and p plus 1 in size and in smoothness probability, and it has the wonderful feature of changing as a changes. And for any particular p, there's going to be some a's that work. Here's a concrete example, and then I'll just about finish off with my description of these methods. If you take z being 20 again and 8 being 10, plug in 10 into the formulas I had before for defining x by and d sub I, then you can observe this particular prime p, and lots of other primes, this particular prime p divides s sub 10. The algebraic reason for that is that if you take the least common multiple times the point 2, 1, you get the point at infinity on the elliptic curve 4a plus 10 y squared equals x cubed plus ax squared plus x. If you look at the order of the curve and the order of that particular point, 2, 1, then you can see why it divides the least common multiple of 1 through 20. The order of 2, 1 on this curve, in this elliptic curve group, is 3 squared times 7 times 11 times 19. The order of any point on the curve actually is going to have its LCM multiple being the point at infinity, because the whole curve has size something close to b here, 2 cubed times 3 squared times 7 times 11 times 19. All right, so any point on the curve will have order dividing that, and therefore dividing the least common multiple of 1 through 20. If you have a random p around this size, then what's the chance of, and you have a random a, what's the chance of the number of points on the curve being a divisor of the LCM, which guarantees that 2, 1 works? Well, if you have some random number around 100,000, then what's the chance of it being 20 smooth? Something like 1 in a few hundred. I haven't worked it out. I tried something like 100 p's and got the 40th one of them was a divisor of S10. So there's, as in the case of the p minus 1 method, the p plus 1 method, some primes are picked out by this. And as you vary a in the elliptic curve method, you get different primes. In order to build a number that is divisible by lots of small, well, all the primes up to y, with less than the square root of y work we were doing before, you write down S1 times S2 times S6 times S10 and so on, each of those being defined in terms of z, and then let's say we take z of those, up to S sub 4z plus 2, something like that. What is the smallest value of z so that if you take z of these s's, then it's divisible, the product of those S sub 1, S sub 2, etc., is divisible by all the primes less than or equal to y? Well, the answer is the same z as before, about e to the square root of half log y log log y. This z has a feature that each of the s's gets 1 over z of the primes. So if you take z of the s's, you get basically all the primes. Okay, maybe you have to multiply that number by log factor to catch the unlucky primes, but basically z being in this range, it is a reasonable conjecture that there is some function converging to zero that you stick in for the little of one there, that if you take the if you take z to be that function with all the exponentials and square roots, and you multiply together s1, s2, s6, s10, z of the s's, each defined in terms of z, with least common multiple of 1 through z, then that product is divisible by every prime less than or equal to y. Furthermore, that product is something that you can compute with only a quadratic, in this very small z, only a quadratic number of multiplications. That's e to the square root of 2 log y multiplications. Therefore, you can also compute it modulo a particular C, with this small C being congruence. You're trying to check for smoothness, with a small number of multiplications. And this is much, much better than y to the 1/2. As y gets big, this scales much more smoothly. Well, it's a much smaller number eventually. Y to the 1/2 would be like, changing that log up to a log. Changing the log up to a log, and maybe reducing the 2 there, but it makes the whole function quite a lot bigger. If y is big enough, then this e to the square root of log is sub-exponential in y. It's y to the 0 plus little o of 1 instead of y to the 1/2. If you optimize early aborts in this context, then you see that the elliptic curve method combined with early aborts ends up having a price-performance ratio of the 2/3 power of this e to the square root blah, 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 which is, in other words, e to the square root of 8/9 log y, compared to before we had y work for trial division becoming square root of y for early abort trial division, y to the 1/2 for rho becoming y to the 1/4. Well, for the elliptic curve method, the best method we have is combining all of these methods with early aborts, mostly using the elliptic curve method. That's most of the computation you're doing. And that ends up taking something like this amount of work per congruence. Well, you write down enough congruences to find enough smooth congruences. This is the amount of work per congruence to find enough smooth congruences. All right, I had a couple more slides, but I'm just about out of time. What I was saying on these slides was, instead of applying these methods, like the elliptic curve method, to congruences that show up in the Q-sieve and so on, you can apply them directly to n. Incidentally, early aborts are not allowed here because you don't want to just abort n if it has no small prime divisors. Let's take the worst case n's that have a couple of big prime divisors. Prime's about the square root of n. And, well, if you choose y to be square root of n and try to find the y smooth factors of n, which when y is about square root of n, that's both the factors of n are y smooth, then the number of multiplications required by the elliptic curve method to write down s1, s2, s6, etc., for an appropriate z, which is sub-exponential in y, is e to the square root of, here's z squared, 12z squared is this quantity, which re-expressing it in terms of n is e to the square root of log n log log n. The 2 disappears because log y is about half of log n. Now, e to the square root of log n is faster than the performance I said for the Q-sieve. So certainly, the Q-sieve is not good to use. Once you know about the elliptic curve method, then hey, why write down more than this number of congruences? Why write down e to the square root of 2 log n congruences when you can just apply the elliptic curve method? It uses very little memory. Actually, this is about as fast as the quadratic sieve, which for many years was everybody's favorite method of finding big prime factors. The elliptic curve method has the same performance, roughly, and it uses much less memory than the quadratic sieve does. On the other hand, the number field sieve, as we'll see next time, replaces the square root of log n by a cube root of log n, and that makes the number field sieve faster than the elliptic curve method for finding big prime divisors. The state of the art for elliptic curve computations is the record for a prime found by the elliptic curve method was about 2 to the 219th. And that was found in, a few hours on an Opteron, 3 times 10 to the 12th Opteron cycles. It was maybe a 2 gigahertz machine, which means 2 billion cycles per second. So this is sounds like an hour on an Opteron for finding a prime about 2 to the 219, a very random number, but somehow multiplying all these S's together found that number. This was, if you look at the chances of this prime being found by the computation, it was lucky for the elliptic curve method to find that prime, but okay, that's the record right now. Next time I'll talk about how fast the number field sieve is, and we'll see that even though the elliptic curve method especially the early abort method, but in this context, even though the elliptic curve method applied to n is very fast, well, the number field sieve is even faster. Thank you for your attention. Questions? Yeah. Sorry, say the question again. So I heard you were saying this is not the conventional introduction to ECM.
I didn't have
like this GCD of this S6 with something that you're trying. How does this relate to the elliptic curves, or I'm not sure still I understand the question. I mean, the derivation of these formulas is a fair amount of work from the elliptic curve. Once you know the elliptic curve addition rules, and you conjecture this, in retrospect, this was the definition of Xi Di, and Peter Montgomery noticed that there's these surprisingly simple formulas for Xi and Di, and actually he simplified them even further in the sense of the number of multiplications needed here. He got down to, you might count this and say it's 12, which is not the same 12 I had before. He got it down to 8, which is, if you multiply it by 1.44, the 12 I was saying before. Anyway, these surprisingly simple formulas are, this very concise definition of what's being computed in the elliptic curve method is, you have to start from thinking, okay, we're doing projective elliptic curve operations on this particular kind of elliptic curve that Peter Montgomery saw would give very fast formulas, and then you notice that consecutive x2i plus 1 d2i plus 1 versus x2i d2i are related to xi and x sub 1 and x sub I plus 1 in a very simple way. And it was some amount of creativity to get these formulas out of the usual elliptic curve formulas. Having these formulas, it's if you go through the calculations, it's the sort of thing where, equipped with a computer algebra system, it's not too hard to check that, yes, these formulas do give you the elliptic curve, you prove by induction that starting from xi and di and xi plus 1 and di plus 1, you prove that x2i, d2i, and so on, that these are the right multiples. But it still takes enough handwork that I recommend doing it with a computer algebra system instead. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question at all. This is certainly not the usual elliptic curve formulas as we introduce elliptic curves with the chord and tangent. These are the highly optimized and surprisingly concise elliptic curve formulas that are used for the fastest computations. Now, I've been trying to present the state of the art in this, and these formulas, along with a little extra tweaking to get rid of some redundant squarings and multiplications, these are the best formulas we know for doing elliptic curve operations. Go ahead. These formulas are due to Peter Montgomery from 1987. Shortly after the elliptic curve method came out, he published this nice paper where he goes through all the different tweaks you can do for the elliptic curve method, and this particular one is used both in the elliptic curve method for factoring and in elliptic curve cryptography, as this is the fastest method we know for doing large characteristic elliptic curve point multiplications using the x-coordinates with these formulas in projective form for the x-coordinates. I wouldn't expect people to recognize these formulas. The translation between these and the chord and tangent description on the elliptic curve is still a fair amount of calculation. It's something that takes half a page just to write down all the necessary calculations, and I don't recommend doing it by hand. And the fact that this was a productive way to go to get to these formulas is Peter Montgomery's observation. The fact that it's useful for exposition, I think I'm the first person to say, hey guys, this is also good for teaching people about the elliptic curve method. But these are the formulas, they magically work. I don't know what to say about that, but on looking at the proof, it's Peter Montgomery, 1987, is the paper that introduced all this. Am I answering your question?
Mm-hmm. Is it also related to inversion?
Yeah, well, this certainly avoids divisions. That's one reason that it makes it so easy to describe. any projective coordinate elliptic curve formulas or hyperelliptic curve formulas very frequently enlarge characteristic. So when you're working mod a big prime instead of with a finite field, let's say 2 to some power. If you're working with a large prime, then divisions are kind of painful. They're certainly slower than multiplications. Not much, much slower, but they're sufficiently slow that we try to avoid any divisions modulo p. And to avoid divisions, you just keep track of the denominator. Instead of dividing xi by di, you have two separate variables for xi and di. And then keep track of the denominators through the rest of your computation, turning divisions into multiplications. You will get similar polynomial formulas for any projective or Jacobian or other denominator elliptic curve formulas. You could also use hyperelliptic curves here if you like. You will get formulas that are kind of like this, although these particular formulas from Montgomery are amazingly simple. This is as a way to compute elliptic curve multiples. I strongly recommend looking at Montgomery's paper for understanding how to really streamline these computations. Okay, other questions? All right, well, thanks again for your attention.